String 10. Librarian. I love planets. Those agglomerations of rocks and volatiles found around most stars throughout the galaxy, and even between the stars. Most living things are born on gas-infused stony orbs. Still, the exceptions are fascinating. I have long studied those ice-bound moons where blind scuttlers arise in secret oceans to stack rocks and burrow deep. Stifled beneath kilometers of mineral-cold ice, they rarely, if ever, get to see the stars, living out a dreaming existence in perpetual sulfur-rich darkness. 3 times I have liberated icy moons, opened crevices in the deep frozen shields, and freed the inbred scuttlers. They climbed up and out, were astonished by the depth and emptiness of the unbounded void of space, and then fell back, terrified and discouraged, to seek refuge again beneath the ice. They wiped their minds and their histories of what I had shown them. Now they do not remember anything about Forerunners. I do not know if their ice will protect them against the halos. Likely not. However, a great many were small, less than the size of my hand. That might save them. How much like those scuttlers all young species are. The empty greatness of space is a thick wall erected between lovers, harsh and cruel. When Forerunners were young and bound to our natal planet, we must have wondered who and what we were, how we would measure up if we met our peers, or our superiors, out there in the void. But the challenge of simply crossing the void was so tremendous that for millennia after we acquired speech, fire, art, machines, we still clung to our rock and shunned the endless vacuum. Inexperience, naivety, hope and fear. Young wisdom. Hulk after ancient hulk we carved open without resistance, without reaction. All records within the equivalent of our ancillas, primitive memory stores, huge and bulky, had decayed to random patterns of binary garble. Binary. After our great memory catastrophes, digital storage had been given way to substrates of quantum foam. Yet on these ships, the last dim hope of log and history crumbled at a touch. 10 million years is a long time for machines. We finished knowing little more than when we began. A vague recognition of shared heritage, a realization that these ships gathered about the star roads like so many flocks of dead birds suspended in a silent gray cathedral, reminded us of archaic designs and builder ritual. No more, and no less.
They were a Forerunner. That's all we may ever know,
Clearance said.
We could transport the best builder technicians out here,
Keeper suggested.
We could set loose our finest researchers to go ship by ship. Then we would learn.
But Keeper's enthusiasm was not convincing. Back in our home galaxy, where nearly all of Forerunner history had played out, preparations to fight the advance of the Flood would certainly take precedence. The one thing we could all surmise about the great fleet we were leaving behind, mute and pitifully old, was that no species had ever mounted such an effort except to save itself. No species had ever gone to such great lengths for any purpose other than all-out war. And what about the precursors, whose cathedral roads stretched around so many planets and interlaced the stars? Where had they gone? Audacity took us to the inner stars of the Great Spider in yet another jump, toward the tiny orange sun. Fresh light from the unique living world greeted us as we arrived in the target system. Light less than 2 seconds old.
Wonderful, fresh light, Chant noted. Makes me feel more connected to reality. What had been statistical from a great distance now resolved to certainty. Here, there were no star roads, no orbiting constructs, no ships.
Audacity brought us sharp images even through the planet's wavering atmosphere. We studied individuals, most seen from above, as well as gatherings in small towns or villages. Tens of thousands, perhaps more, but certainly not millions. A lonely and simple planet. Our emotions reached down. Their technological status is minimal. Fire, ceramics, some metalworking, Dawn said.
Because they are so few, even compared to their resources, they must exercise population control. Beyond that, they seem to have returned to a state of natural evolution.
Chant continued with less startling details. Subsurface and volcanic vent biota is non-existent. There's nothing in the way of an underground biosphere. No signs of ancient reservoirs of fuel, carbonaceous or petroleum-based.
If they arrived with the fleet, Keeper said, they've been here 10 million years.
A prospect so astonishing it could scarcely be believed. Either their ancestors had been forced to colonize a desperately impoverished planet, or they had long ago shed most of their knowledge.
We absorbed this with the proper silent respect.
Lack of resources could hold back progress,
Keeper said. I noticed a certain doubtful disdain in his tone.
Even so, they must have stripped themselves of everything, Dawn said in wonder.
Or they were abandoned, left here with nothing,
Clearance said.
Judging from the mineral evidence, life didn't exist before it came here with the Forerunners. There is a fair percentage of radioactive ore, however, and the oceans, such as they are rich with deuterium.
They could have escaped if they had wanted to, I concluded.
Weapons?
I asked Audacity.
Nothing that can harm us,
the ship responded. They live and work by fire alone, and not a great deal of that.
But why?
Chant asked.
Audacity entered low orbit.
We're intercepting sounds, Dawn said, and with a lift of her fingers played for us words being spoken in a small village just a few hundred kilometers below.
We understood nothing.
It's not ancient Daigon?
Keeper asked.
That reached its peak less than 300,000 years ago, Dawn said. We have no idea what form of Daigon, if any, even existed when the fleet left our galaxy. Ship will gather sounds from as many points as possible, but already the language seems far simpler than our own.
Simpler language is often more advanced, syntactically,
Keeper said, and brightened at a thought.
Their technology and structures might be hidden. They might be in defensive mode, hiding them. There could be threats in Path Kathona we do not recognize.
More likely they chose to suppress technology at the deepest level, Dawn said.
Keeper fell back in dismay. He could not bring himself to believe Forerunners would ever abandon advanced engineering.
No doubt they still dig,
Clearance said with a smug air.
They've become miners, all of them. How else would they find stone and clay?
I have difficulty knowing when miners are trying to be funny. None of us had ever seen Forerunners so abject and primitive. They averaged about two-thirds the height and mass of a healthy manipular. Their structures were rarely taller than one or two stories, or wider than 5 or 10 meters.
How can we learn anything from them? Keeper asked. How can they maintain any sort of culture?
They likely rely on oral histories, Chant said. We've seen it in other species.
Maybe there's some sort of flood residue. An inept crossbreeding,
Keeper said. The genetic heritage is clear, Chant insisted. At the cellular level, they aren't very different from us. I think the first group to arrive made the best of a tough situation. They could not overburden meager resources. But there are other animals down there, some serving as beasts of burden. With a twist of judgment, she added, and some as food. She paused to enjoy our surprise.
Forerunners have not consumed animals for many millions of years.
More interesting still, their animals show descent from the original population, including those they eat. Even the plants have Forerunner genetics, if they are in fact plants. They likely arrived without a genetic library, hence no way to create a complex ecosystem. They used what they had. She looked up, eyes round. I wonder if they'd enjoy eating us.
Keeper could not contain his disgust.
What could they have done to deserve such degradation?
Nothing like it in our history, Dawn said.
Chant did her best to put together a useful social picture of our long-lost relatives.
Audacity decided that landing directly on the planet still posed too much risk. We could not yet be sure whether what we were seeing was real
or whether the forerunners below, even should they be the sole masters of this strange world and not peculiar pets, might be hiding their true level of technology. Keeper, in particular, favored this view. He preferred an explanation of camouflage and hidden danger over what he deemed forerunner disgrace. Audacity brought forth two excursion craft, seekers with the lightest of armaments. A quick lottery of needs and circumstance determined that three of us would descend and two would remain in orbit. I insisted on joining the excursion. Our seekers penetrated a low deck of thin clouds, then followed the sinuous contours of the greatest range of craggy mountains, between which lay immense freshwater lakes. Because the planet's axis was perpendicular to its orbit, and had been for many hundreds of millions of years, the land had never been subject to heavy winters or severe glaciations. The weather was steady and dull, low, overcast much of the time. Infrequent but violent thunderstorms, heavy precipitation that nonetheless brought only light snow to the highest mountains. The planet had only one small ocean that covered the southern polar regions, its dense, salty waters filled with bitter minerals. All the other water on the planet was fresh and contained in the deep, clear lakes. Our seekers flew over a low mountain ridge, then dropped and hovered a few thousand meters above a brown, gently sloping plain. The breaking of thin lava dikes had long ago broached one of the deep lakes, loosing immense floods that had shaped chaotic terrain across the northern third of the plain. The plant-like growth here was scrubby, set low to resist channeled winds between the wrinkled mountain ridges. Winds that blew sand and carved tumuli, caprocks, and other grotesque formations. At the southern end of the rugged mountains, the mouth of a narrow valley revealed a great cleft in the range, faced with pale vertical faces of granitic rock. Clearance was not impressed by the local geology.
"A place of exile, not opportunity," he said. "I would not have chosen it."
"Spoken like a miner," Chant said. "Life workers would see other opportunities, other forces at work. In my experience, a lean and barren world could force rapid cultural growth that would in turn promote a quick renewal of technology. We do enjoy our creature comforts, but that was not the case here. Who or what had compelled them to seek this strange penance, to become a focus of all evolution, with the unavoidable result of cannibalism? The seekers landed us within a kilometer of a town. Low, flat dwellings lay like sedimentary layers on the slope of a low ridge. We climbed down to survey the plain and the flat town. Clearance, on my instruction, stayed close to his vehicle. A low wall lay within 40 meters of our landing. Within the wall, 10 squat, tawny-furred animals, each massing about 500 kilograms, grazed on the few dusky green shoots that poked up through cracked and crumbled soil. The wall was likely a channel to keep small floods from intruding into the town. The grazing animals easily stepped over it to find fresh shoots. Clouds blew free from the mountains. Sunshine played over the rolling, crackled ground. "Look at their faces," Chant said. I already had, and did not like the resemblance. I approached the closest animal. It stood its ground and patiently watched through closely spaced gray eyes. "Looks like Clearance," Chant said. Clearance framed his face with his gloves and looked domestic. "Stop that," I said.
"Apologies."
"More like Keeper," I suggested. Chant covered her mouth. I stooped a few meters from the beast, rather the adapted forerunner, to more closely examine its feet. The digits and phalanges were indeed based on a stem forerunner body plan. These creatures were as related to us as their herdsmen in the buildings beyond, but intelligence was not apparent. The grazer turned its head, incurious, and bent its neck to pluck more shoots. A few hundred meters to the north, closer to the town's outlying buildings and surrounded by another low wall, lay a plot of gray-green bushes. If we approached that plot, almost certainly we would be noticed and challenged. I looked back to Clearance. "It's much more likely they'll see our kinship without armor," Clearance, standing beside the first seeker, was not enthusiastic. In our helmets, we heard him say,
I doubt they'd recognize us even if we were naked. They've fallen so very far.
Even so, I said, then instructed my ancilla. My armor unfolded, pulled away, and arranged itself neatly on the compacted dry mud. My ancilla and I had long ago reached an agreement about solicitous warnings. None were given. It knew my mind. I shall go in without armor as well, Chant said. No, just me. Life Shaper. Both of my shipmates looked distressed. Just me, I insisted. Clearance will stay here to back us up. I preferred for the miner to remain by the seekers, in case Chant and I were suffering from that willful blindness that sometimes afflicts life workers too fascinated by nature to recognize a threat. She and I walked across the dried mud. I wore only underlinings, feet bare but for thong socks. The ground was hard and cold, the air brisk but not dangerously so. At my signal, Chant fell back about 20 paces. She had wanted to precede me, but I forbade it. Our training was explicit in how to approach indigenes, but never had we approached forerunners in such circumstances. At any rate, they were indigenous only by courtesy. The courtesy of 10 million years habitation was real enough, however. Beyond a waist-high mud and stone wall, no doubt built to keep out the grazers, a tilled field supported many rows of grey-green stalks, topped by spiky leaves, below which hung wrinkled-looking fruit or pods. The wind rustled leaves and fruit. They sounded dry and unappetizing, but whatever their genetics, they looked the part of fixed plants, not forerunners doing penance rooted in dirt. Neither of us intruded on the patch. Rather, we kept outside the wall and thus were directed toward the nearest complex of buildings, irregular pentagonal structures made of mud brick, with stones pieced out along their foundations. The mud had been scored with crude strings of unfamiliar symbols. Oblong doorways were spaced one or two to each building, each covered by a rough woven hanging. In the nearest doorway, a wrinkled, thick hand drew back a hanging, and for just a moment a shadowy figure stood there, striking an odd pose, naked, as if hoping for inspection and approval. A female, I was fairly sure, but not in her prime, with shrunken belly teats and very different patterns of facial hair. Most distinct, a line of gray fur reached around from her cheeks to join beneath a flat, pushed-back nose. At least that was classically forerunner. The female darted back and the curtain dropped. In another doorway, back among the main cluster of dwellings, another curtain drew aside and a second figure stepped into filtered sunshine. A male with a square, broad face, thick furred about chin and forehead, columnar legs supported a squat and bulky torso. He wore heavy gray clothing. His face was rugged, observant, but lacked any readable expression. Behind him, silhouetted by the flickering glow of a fire or lantern, stood a younger female dressed in lighter clothing. Sexual dimorphism was evident, but not extreme. They were far closer to each other in appearance than I was to the didact. But of course, ours was an artificial dimorphism, rate determined, and it seemed they had given up all that here, if ever they had possessed it. I was fascinated. Never had I seen forerunners so different from our root stock. Less than 1.5 meters in height, broad across shoulders and midriff, thick of leg and short of arm with long, curling fingers, 5 fingers only on each hand. I subdued a familiar giddiness of discovery. My ancilla would have controlled that response with a subtle tickle in my brainstem. Now, I swallowed hard and drew myself back to full alertness, forcing a deliberate pinch of anxiety. The wind ruffled my underlinings, as I had expected, making my own shape clear. To them, I would appear strangely tall and slender, eyes large, skin pale. I doubted they would recognize our kinship by sight alone. I held out my hands. One thing we do know is that early forerunners had a keen sense of smell and used it to determine kinship and other social relations. The breeze now blew from behind. The male sniffed through wide nostrils, wider than my own.
He stepped forward with a light sway, bandy-legged to a degree that reminded me of a first-form warrior servant, around the corner of the dwelling, where he stopped and gestured to the female, who now also came forward. "All is well. We have traveled far, and we are here to speak with you," I said, in the most ancient known Daigon dialect. "We come from our old home to this new home. Are you well?" The male waved his hand and made an ululating hoot. The female shunted sideways toward the male. Neither seemed afraid. The female canted her head, studying me. Her nostrils flared. It didn't seem much of a stretch to interpret her reaction as intrigued but puzzled. Throughout the dwellings, more hangings parted and other figures appeared, males, females, all of middle age or older. Obviously, they allowed themselves to age in natural time. No children were visible. On all the dwellings, the walls had been stamped with unfamiliar symbols. But along the outward-facing wall of one dwelling, prominently displayed, 10 large circular emblems had been carved, repetitions of a mark so often found in forerunner decorations that in our daily lives we hardly noticed its presence. A circle around a tree-like branch of angular veins. Long ago, among life workers, I had heard it referred to as the Eld. Others, mostly builders, called it the tree mark. Forerunners had associated it with the mantle for as long as can be remembered, but its origin remained a mystery. And yet here it was, confirming what? Memorializing what, precisely? Again, I felt a deep unease. To come all this distance and find brothers and sisters completely isolated and in such circumstances, yet still exhibiting the most ubiquitous mark of forerunner culture. Why should that surprise or chill me? But it did. Something in me did not want to find the Eld, with all its associations and connections. Not here. A small crowd gathered in a loose clump between the low dwellings. The bulky male had ceased his hooting. No one else made a sound. I shifted my gaze around the group, then repeated what I had said before, adding, "We are forerunners. You are the same. Is there anyone here who speaks of times past?" The old Daigon did not come easily. No doubt the Ancilla could have pronounced the words better, or gotten the grammar more correct. Words live as genes live. Some parts conserved, others wildly variable. But then, we already knew it was unlikely they understood even this old tongue. An older female broke from the group, and with a shrug of her shoulders walked towards us, stopping within 3 paces. Chant seemed ready to intervene, but I waggled my hand behind my back. The old female stared beyond my shoulder, then turned her eyes on me. She pulled thin lips back from strong gray teeth, favoring me with a full-blown smile. These forerunners were still capable of that rictus, while I could barely manage to lift the corners of my lips. But I did my best, and again held out my hands. The female grasped my outstretched fingers. Her own fingers were covered with dirt and green stains. They felt greasy, but her grip was firm. She tugged gently, urging me to come with her, and again favored me with a smile. I followed. After 10 long steps, we seemed to cross a line, and the rest rushed forward to surround us. A smaller group broke free and encircled Chant. In her armor, she towered above them all, in a posture of calmness and caution, as we had been trained. Best to appear neither too friendly nor defenseless and predictable. The crowds merged, corralling us into their center, touching us not unkindly but with rude familiarity. Chant's eyes flashed. Their touches grew more intimate. They wished to know everything about me. What they discovered surprised them. They pulled back a little, dismayed, but kept smiling. Our methods of reproduction had diverged substantially over millions of years. The crowd now parted, forming a channel down which another much older female, with stiff, steely gray fur on both crown and shoulders, pushed through, waved the first female aside, and took a position beside me, then looked at all the others as if daring them to interfere. She turned and grasped my wrist, lifting my arm. The others pulled back. She looked up into my face, smiled brilliantly, showing strong teeth,
grey and none too clean. At that moment, I swear that but for the nose and fur, she seemed almost human. Something in her eyes, her curiously committed expression, an atavistic glimpse at what may have been our common roots long, long ago. And then she bit me, fastened those grey teeth into my forearm, jerked her jaw sidewise, opening up shallow but painful wounds. I did not move, did not cry out, held my ground. She jerked back, blood purple on her lips and teeth. My blood, and again that smile. I pulled loose, looking down on her in wonder. She seemed proud of my reaction. Clearance had returned to his seeker the moment the crowd surrounded us. Now he shot over our heads, releasing a swarm of small monitors, followed by a fusillade of blinding flashes and snapping booms. The crowd scattered. The seeker dropped. Manipulators reached down, took hold of Chant and me, and lifted us out of the village, through the air, back to our own seeker. In that same sweep, with a few wrenching maneuvers, he gathered up my folded armor as well, and then set us all down, gently enough, but in truth, the flight had hurt me more than the bite. "I didn't ask for help," I said. Clearance dropped from his seeker and glared at us.
"You were attacked," he said. "They were chewing on you."
Amused, woozy from shock, I had to agree. Chant examined my arm. The bites were clean, shallow but thorough, and covered with spittle. "Don't spray them," I told her. She looked up in disbelief. "Leave them be," I insisted. "What if there's an infection or a poison?" she asked. "Then we'll learn something and the armor will take care of it. I regret only that we frightened them. Leave me be. I'm all right." She looked me over in irritation. "As a direct command life shaper, I must obey, but I protest you're taking that kind of risk."
"As do I," Clearance said.
"Think it so if you must," I said, "but think it through first." They both made a show of considering. Then Chant said stubbornly, "I cannot see it as you do, life shaper. That's because you are more concerned about my welfare than about learning why these people are here," I said. "But that is our mission. I do not refuse your aid out of spite." "Why then? Think about what you saw." Chant bowed her head. "You sense a relationship with the old female. Please put on your armor at the very least, in case there is danger." I did as she suggested, but refused my Ancilla's treatment as I had Chant's. "Give it time," I said. "Something benign was intended. I'm sure of it."
"Violence is benign here?" my Ancilla asked.
"The better question is, why would she bite only me?" I favored them with a glow of intrigue.
"Because Chant was armored," Clearance said.
The situation had given him a scare and he would take a while to recover his calm. Strangely, I felt jubilant, then contented, happy. Something in my wounds? A toxin? No, a message, and a small reward for allowing myself to be bitten.
"You are not thinking clearly, Life Shaper," Clearance said. "We will remedy that."
"No, let it be. Let me feel all of it." Clearance was dumbfounded.
"We are responsible, Life Shaper. We should return to Audacity. If you are injured, if you die..."
Chant reached out to quiet him, then dropped her head in obeisance. "Enlighten me, Life Shaper."
"Enlighten us,"
Clearance insisted. "I feel fine. Interesting, but fine. Let's stay here for a while and see what they do next." We stood back near the seekers and watched as the village calmed. No apparent offense was taken at Clearance's harrying. The people returned to their huts, all but the old female, who stared across the distance between us, face fixed and pale, waiting. We had found forerunners. Whether they remembered anything of that ancient fleet or why they had come to this planet, we had no way of knowing. But these people were our only way of getting an answer. And judging from what I had seen in the old female's expression as her teeth sank into my flesh, there were more surprises to come. The bite was not a warning. It was a prelude, a test, and perhaps one way to trade diagnostic samples. Touch is direct and meaningful, but tissue tells the tale. Night's shadow moved along the valley and up the mountains. The dim, thousand-veiled red and purple glow of the spider, young stars blurred as if through tears of old emotion, rose high over the land. In the twilight, on this world there was never true night or darkness, we kept vigil, while from the village rose a few distant cries, shouts, and then silence, perhaps sleep. No doubt Keeper and Dawn circling the planet in audacity would take it personally if I or the others were injured. My foolhardiness would doubtless cause distress as they contemplated having to greet the Didact when he emerged from his cryptum with the grim news of his wife's distant demise. But the Didact and I had parted in the all-too-poignant awareness we might never see each other again. That was the least of my worries. I could feel changes coming. My intuition was confirmed while we rested in the larger of the two seekers and reconsidered our options. I allowed my armor to conduct a deep analysis of my situation, but not to intervene, not yet. When it had finished, the Ancilla interrupted my meditation, flashing a spectrum of concern. "There is no poison, Lifeshaper," it announced, "but you harbor foreign microbes."
"Forerunner genetics?"
"Entirely. From the old female's bite. No particles in the air or the soil have such properties. You anticipated this?"
"We see primal choices and minimal technology, but that may be deceptive. They use what they have."
"Yet they remain bound to this planet."
"They have no immediate need to leave. They may be happy."
"Contented forerunners." My Ancilla took on a dubiously green cast. "The particles are spreading throughout your system and your nervous system, into your brain. We cannot let them continue. What you are in immediate need of is a purge. The danger is too great."
"Are the particles provoking any immune response?"
"Not yet, Lifeshaper. You are calm and happy. I do not know what that implies."
"I was happy. Happier than I had been in many years. But I knew it would not last. I think it will be important that I return to the old woman and allow her to bite me again." The Ancilla flashed through another spectrum.
"Your goal is obscure, Lifeshaper."
"Be patient," I suggested, closing my eyes. It seemed likely that biting, or being bitten, was a two-way process here. What could the woman learn from retrieving a few of her tiny scouts, even now conducting a no doubt delicate but thorough survey, and without provoking my extremely vigilant immune system? What did she need to learn? I spoke of this to none of the others, and did not communicate with Audacity on the matter. Morning would come soon, and even I preferred to act out my theories in the light of day. Night is a difficult time for those who live close to nature. Day is safer. We had long since lost the habit of sleep. In our armor, all the needs of sleep are taken care of, and a smooth, healthy continuity of consciousness is possible. What dreams we infrequently succumb to. Waking dreams are administrative and diagnostic. Housekeeping dreams. Hardly amusing at all. Yet in the dark, with the old woman's scouts coursing through me, I was beginning to shed my calm. I was beginning to dread the silence and the inaction, and what tomorrow might bring.
Sunrise pushed through a thin deck of clouds, gray and sad. We passed our complete reports to Audacity, then planned our return to the town. Again, all would wear armor except for me.
"They eat their relatives, you know," Chant reminded me. "What if they decide you taste better?"
"I'm sure I do," I said. "Better than those." I looked toward the grazing livestock. "Certainly cleaner." My favorite teacher, from whom I had taken my maturing imprint, had stated to all her charges, "Life is deadly to all its parts. No emotion fits our challenge better than humor." I still showed no obvious reaction to the old woman's bite. No swelling, no fever, no other sign of infection or distress, but something was definitely working within me. I murmured to myself, lips moving in an unfamiliar way. The words made sense. I understood them, but they came strangely to my lips. My muscles had to grow accustomed to shaping such sounds. The new words, new to me and my muscles, demanded a great many tonguing flexures and rattling glottals. Before I shed my armor, the ancilla reiterated its concern. Your mind is changing, Lifeshaper. The particles are distressingly active. I replied, something's teaching me. It's strange, but I don't think it's dangerous. Not yet. And then I removed my helmet, stepped out of the armor, and crossed the cracked plain, again in just flimsy underlinings. The wind was brisker and colder this morning and chilled me deeply. Remember, I said to Chant and Clearance, no intervention. What if they tried to kill you? Chant asked. I rolled up one sleeve, an open invitation. They won't, I said, but how I knew that I could not explain even to myself. The old woman smiled. She thought you were funny, and you needed to be let in on the joke. I walked into the town. In a sketchy manner, I saw the buildings quite differently, felt a growing familiarity with everything around me. I began to see and then feel the austere beauty of the Seer Mountains, the spare, fit design of the town spread beneath their rising shadow, the glory of the spider's nighttime glow. These forerunners had not given up so much after all. They had simply grown into a new sophistication, using all that had been left to them. By biting me, the old female was infusing me with what she knew, and perhaps much more. Already a kind of context was filling in around those strange words, like paint spreading out between the lines. The bite had been a gift. With that gift, in my flesh, in my mind, came not just their language, not just a sense of place and an awareness of their essential nature, but their version of history.